Welcome to the podcast of Greenlight Bookstore. This is the quarantine season. While Greenlight isn't currently hosting in-person gatherings, we're still striving for ways to create connection around books. Thanks to the gracious efforts of authors and interviewers scattered across the country and the world, we've taken our events programming online, hosting live readings, conversations, and audience questions via Zoom. Our podcasts this season are a record of those intimate conversations between thinkers and creators speaking from separate rooms, and a window into the ways that ideas and stories connect us all. Once you've listened to the conversation, you can purchase the books mentioned in this podcast at Greenlight's two bookstore locations in Brooklyn or on our website at greenlightbookstore.com.
Hi, everybody. Welcome and good evening. Welcome to tonight's live online author event with Greenlight Bookstore. I'm Jackie from Greenlight Bookstore, and we're thrilled to host tonight's event with Michaela Carter, presenting her new book, Leonora in the Morning Light. She will be talking with Kate Christensen, so you're in for an excellent time. Before we start, I just want to say a huge thanks to Michaela, Kate, and the team at Avid Reader Press for making this happen, and to all of you for showing up. Though we're not able to host events in our store spaces at the moment, our community of authors and readers is still here. We're so grateful for your support and for the chance to make space for conversation and connection. Importantly, tonight's featured book, Leonora in the Morning Light, is available for sale from Greenlight Bookstore, and we're excited to sell it. You can shop in person in our bookstore locations from 12 to 7 every day of the week, and you can purchase Michaela's book and many others on site. Or you can order online at greenlightbookstore.com for a quick pickup at the store or for shipping anywhere in the U.S., if you care about supporting the careers of authors like Michaela and the ongoing existence of independent bookstores like Greenlight, buying tonight's featured book is a great way to show your support. So our interviewer tonight is Kate Christensen. She's the author of 7 novels, including The Great Man, which won the 2008 Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction, and The Last Cruise, published in paperback from Vintage Inker in June 2019. She's also published 2 food-centric memoirs, Blue Pate Special and How to Cook a Moose, which won the 2016 Maine Literary Award for Best Memoir. Kate has written reviews and essays for numerous publications, including Tin House and Vogue, The New York Times, and Food and Wine. Kate lives in Portland with her husband and their 2 dogs. She will be speaking this evening with our featured author, Michaela Carter. Michaela is a writer, painter, and an award-winning poet. Her novel, Further Out Than You Thought, was an Indie Next pick, an Arizona Republic Recommends, and an Arizona Central's Best Critics pick for 2014. Her poetry has won the Poetry Society of America, Los Angeles New Poets Prize, and has been nominated for Pushcart Prizes and has appeared in numerous anthologies and journals. She's the co-founder of the wonderful independent bookstore, the Peregrine Book Company, where she works as a buyer. She lives in Prescott, Arizona with her husband and her 2 dogs. Her new book, Leonora in the Morning Light, is an unforgettable story of love, art, and destiny that restores a 20th century heroine to her rightful place in our collective imagination. Michaela will start us off this evening with a reading from the book, and then she'll be speaking with Kate and with all of you. So please take it away, Michaela. Thanks so much for being here tonight. We're so excited to celebrate your release.
Thank you so much, Jackie and Greenlight, for having me, and thank you, Kate, for being here with me. I thought I would read Just a couple of pages from a section. The book is actually written in 3 different voices, Leonora Carrington, Max Ernst, and Peggy Guggenheim. And this is from Leonora's section, December 1937 in Paris, and Leonore Finney is at her door. Standing in the doorway, wearing the robe of a cardinal and with a basket in her hand, Finney looked like Little Red Riding Hood. She offered her the basket. From inside it came a muffled roar, and Leonora lifted the lid to find a tiny tiger, an orange kitten. "One of Athena's litter," said Finney. "I couldn't keep them all, no matter how much I wanted to. Girl or boy?" She lifted the kitten from the basket. "Girl, of course. Not that I have a thing against boys, but female cats are the best. I'll call her Wolf. Loop? Wolf, after Virginia." Leonora touched her nose to the tiny cold nose. The kitten caught a claw in her hair and shook it to get free. "I know you don't read in English, but you'd love the waves. You should translate it for me. I'd never be good enough. Tell me the story then." Leonora smiled. "It isn't the sort you can tell." Wolf batted at her arm. and leapt under the sofa. Finney pulled off the robe and stood in the kitchen, naked in her heels. "These robes are hard to wash and chicken splatters," she explained, as she pulled the hen's plucked bodies from her bag. "Give me your sharpest knife." Leonora handed her the butcher's knife, and she slapped a chicken on the cutting board and hacked into its rubbery flesh. When Leonora had first come to Paris, Max had made a delicious paella for them. But that, she learned, was a special occasion, and soon he'd begun to expect dinner. Finney had begun the cooking lessons then, beef bourguignon, confit de canard, il flottant. And Leonora looked forward to those afternoons they spent drinking wine and concocting magic, just as Max looked forward to the dinners and the candlelit company of the two Leonores, as he'd come to call them. "I don't see how women do it," she'd confided to Finney. "How do they clean and cook and still have time to paint?" "Look at it creatively," she'd said. "When you clean, you are dressing a set on which a marvelous play will unfold. The story of your life, ma chérie. When you cook, you are an alchemist, a witch. The pot on the stove is your cauldron. Max comes and goes, yes, but this is your realm, the one you control. Of course, I live most of the time with a caravan of men and cats, so no one can expect much of anything." Leonora didn't mind. And besides, whenever she and Max went out to eat, there was the possibility of Marie Bert turning up and spoiling things. And Marie Bert is Max's wife. She had a sixth sense which rooted out his whereabouts the way a pig roots out truffles. Leonora thought of her that way, like a pig sniffing at the dirt, or else a jailer holding Max with an ugly desperation. It had happened again last week at Le Deux Magots. Marie Bert screeching through coffee cups at her, and Max put his arm around Leonora firmly and told his wife to go home. They watched her limp away on her heels. She should have felt pity, but in the moment it was impossible. Marie Bert had been shaking as if she might break free, grab her by the hair and do what? Of what violence might she be capable? "You know he still sees her, Marie Bert," Leonora said, pouring a good Bordeaux into two glasses. She swirled the wine around and brought it to her nose. Leather, chocolate. Sipping it, she tasted blackberry and smoke. "He's afraid if he doesn't look in on her, she'll take her life. She has a gun." "Maybe you should take over," Finney said, offering her the knife. "It feels good to whack away." Leonora pulled off her white blouse and her skirt and hung them over a chair. She brought the knife down hard into the chicken. Finney was right. It felt good. A leg launched across the counter. A wing careened to the floor. Finney put the pieces in the frying pan, melting butter and adding lardon, cubes of pig fat for flavor. She doused the chicken in red wine, sending steam over their faces and chests. "As long as I've known him, he's always had more than one woman at a time," she said, as she added mushrooms. "It's his way. He says he loves me." Leonora knew she sounded desperate and tried to laugh it off. "In any case, it's nothing more than some bourgeois notion of love that makes me want him for myself." Finney covered the chicken. She turned to her, took her hand. "We want what we want. Now show me this painting." The windows had misted over with steam and the flat was thick with the smell of chicken and wine. Lifting the sheet that covered her self-portrait, Leonora held her breath. She'd shown it to no one, not even to Max. Finney nodded, putting an arm around her, and the two of them looked at the painted woman, this other Leonora, whom Carrington had given birth to, the one who stared straight back and seemed not to need anything from anyone.
I'm so glad you read that section, because that perfectly leads into what I want to start talking to you about, which is that self-portrait. But
wonderful.
Yeah. But before we get into the self-portrait, I want to say just a few things about our connection and how I've never met you, but I've been a fan of your work since your first book. And I remember blurbing it. I think I blurbed it. And I absolutely
it was so nice to blur it.
It was a pleasure. And I genuinely loved it. And I felt like whatever you wrote next, I wanted to read. And I do feel that there is a connection between this book and your first book, in the sense of the intersection, this sort of intertwining of art and domestic responsibility and the political sort of upheaval that you wrote about LA just after the Rodney King verdict and the riots. And one of your characters was a sort of performance artist, a young performance artist, and the other was a woman who had just found out she was pregnant. And there was a third also, I'm trying to remember the third.
Musician, another musician who was dying of AIDS.
Actually. Right.
But yeah, their friend.
Right. So it's again, this sort of communal, and I feel like you took all the themes in that book and sort of exploded them in this book. And all in you have three voices again in this book. You have Peggy Guggenheim, Max Ernst, and Leonora Carrington, who's the center of the book, and her art and her genius and her sort of discovery of what her genius is by believing in it is sort of the center of the book. But it's extraordinary, I feel, what you've been able to. It's a historical novel, I know, but it also feels incredibly timely and incredibly apropos. And so I first want to ask, before we get into the self-portrait, because I want you to tell the story of the self-portrait in the museum. I found that essay you wrote, and it's wonderful. But I want to ask you a little bit about the timeline of writing this book, because it took you 7 years. And when you started it, it was the Obama era. And when you finished it, it was the Trump era. So the country was going through its own. You were writing about the time right as World War II was sort of boiling up, and Hitler was sort of coming into whatever you want to call it. And you write about Max in a concentration camp, and on the train coming back. So my question, this is a very long-winded way of asking you, so how did the book sort of, and this would be a good time to talk about the self-portrait, I guess, the inception of the book, and then the whole process that you went through while everything was changing in this country as you wrote it.
Wow. Yeah, it did really seem to come more, to become more applicable or like more kind of timely or something, you know, I mean, with the fascism, kind of like, yeah, all the kind of the rise of fascism, right? Yeah. And with Obama, because it really started out, I'd kind of started this, just something I was working on that was really close to my life. And that first book further out had been very close to my life. And, but I had these postcards on my wall from going to Paris with my daughter after she graduated high school. And I was like, I want to go there. That's where I want to spend my time. Like, you know, if I'm going to spend all this time alone in this room, I want to go there. And an artist, like, I want to hang out with the coolest artists, you know, like, yeah. I love artists, and I love groups of artists. And, you know, and then now when we can't hang out with anyone, I want to like find that kind of group again that I could go kind of surround myself with. But it's hard to like to follow up with the surreal, you know, after the surrealists. So anyhow, like I knew about the surrealists kind of more through the writing and that kind of thing. Like they had so many cool exercises and like ways of getting the unconscious to kind of come into what you're doing, you know. And I had taught them a lot when I taught writing at college, and I loved it. But I knew that I wanted a woman to be at the center of it. And yeah, in the books that I had at the time and like online and things, I couldn't find them. Who was with them? Like, it's all men, you know, and all that, that famous picture of them with like Dully and Breton and Ernst and this group of men, right, from the 20s that started surrealism. But, you know, there were these amazing women around them. And I didn't know. So I went in 2013 to Europe, to like France, and then also to England. And that was where I saw at the Tate Modern Leonora's painting that I just, like, it was this little painting, like kind of high on the wall. And, you know, I'm like, why can I not look at this better? I was up on my toes. And then my husband ended up finding her book in the gift shop, and I stole it from him and just dove in. And I was like, this is who I felt like she needed to be written about. And then I also felt like this is the story I need to write next too. Cause I think those two things have to really kind of meld, or you can't commit that much time to something, you know?
Yeah.
It has to kind of match up with something inside you, I think.
You're a painter, right? As well as a poet and so I'm wondering if how your work, this is another thing I was curious about reading the book, sort of how her paintings struck you and resonated with you in terms of your own paintings.
Ah, that's so cool. Okay, well, yeah, I mean, I guess I didn't get to, so then I went and visited her self-portrait at the Met. Okay. and that was, like, I knew I had to see that painting in person, like the real painting. Because, you know, you can look at them in books, but they just, that it doesn't have the same energy. And so, seeing her painting, I noticed this blur that was on the floor, that kind of where she had wiped something out, can't tell what is there, what had been there. And so it became this mystery that kind of propelled me through the writing of it to figure out, like, what maybe was there, and then also why she wiped it out. And like that kind of revealed to me that she really had needed Max's approval then. Because here she became this, you know, lived 94 years and made more than 2,000 works of art. Like, oh my God.
It's amazing.
Amazing. Yeah. 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 But
so you imagine that
what was your
No. I'm staying with this question because I just realized this. Can I read a little line from your book?
Of course.
She is talking to. Hang on. She's thinking about Max, who comes in right at the end of the scene you read and looks at the painting and doesn't react. And she's very young and very self-conscious about her work, and he's never seen it before. And what you imagined was connected to the Irish fairy folk, which gets into her entire sort of her whole mythology in her work, which is both personal and also draws from all sorts of, you know, folk tales and fairy tales and mythology and stories. And she sort of developed over the years her own kind of. So I feel like by the end of the book, she's setting a table for the Irish fairy folk. But here, she wipes it out because Max, you imagined it. And this is your explanation, which is completely, I feel like it's the nexus of the book in a way. Like, you imagined that she was so desirous of male approval at the beginning of her painting career that she, that smudge that you were sort of looking at that sort of led you into her mind and led and sort of made her, you know, because she was this genius who lived 100 years ago and died in 1960 something.
She died recently. Like, she died 10 years ago. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wait
a minute. So she lived, then like to be 94. So, but yeah.
She was born in 1917.
Yeah.
So she's 21 when the book opens.
Yeah.
Or 20. really young. But anyway, I love that story, and I love because it's a historical novel and because she was a real life person. But you made her your own in the course of writing the book, and so it's as another novelist. I was sort of reading, thinking how. So what was the question you were asking at the beginning? And then I came across this essay which sort of answered it for me. And I think it's a sort of, this gets into you as a painter also, because it's a very painterly thing to notice. It's a very sort of, you know, one painter would notice that another painter had done that. I, not being a painter, much as I wish I were a painter, might not have had that same insight or that same imaginative leap into her work and into who she was at the time when she did this, the only self-portrait she ever did. So now this is my next question. So how does her work connect to yours, or does it? And was the thing that led you into her a sense of kinship, or is there, you know, is your work really profoundly different?
You know, I felt like her work spoke to me just on so many levels. Like you were saying, like the myth and the Irish, the fairy tales, that sense of magic. And a lot of my work it's out of my imagination. It comes a lot from dreams, or like just being struck by some image that then comes through, not necessarily realistic, or like going off of a photograph or something like that, you know? So that definitely spoke to me as an artist. And then she's just so inspired me. Like, while I was writing it, I did a bunch of paintings. I kind of have a different love-hate relationship with painting than I have with writing. but, you know, it's mostly love. But painting, I'm afraid of sometimes, until I can, like, I know I have time to really do it. Because once I start, I get so obsessed. Just, like, I can't leave it. And then it's sitting there looking back at you. You know, at least you can close the computer or the notebook or whatever, and it goes away, you know. But then when you're painting, I'll just like paint late into the night or whatever, just to try to get it where, you know, you think it can be or something, because I know it'll just bug me, you know, so much until that can happen.
Yeah.
She has just like inspired me. Because really, like, as much as I admired the surrealist men, their work was more intellectual to me, and not, it didn't hit me on that like emotional, kind of like real dream space place that, like Carrington's work and Leonore Finney, Dorothea Tanning too.
And, I love the scenes you have with the women who are each other's muses. And there's this whole, you're very funny also.
Thank you.
First of all, just the writing in this book is so absolutely clear. And you're writing about madness and surrealism and this wild group of people. I mean, there are all these utopian sort of moments throughout the book where everyone is just naked and sleeping with one another and like cooking amazing food and painting and talking about art. And I wanted to live in the world of this book forever. And I can see why it appealed to me. But you're very funny about the male-female tensions. And Leonora, who I loved instantly as soon as she started, you know, existing in the pages of the book, is so much herself, despite her craving for approval when she's young, which we, you know, all relate to. She has a gimlet eye, and she sees, she has this alliance with her fellow women artists that is sort of outside the surrealists. And I love the way Finney is always stomping around in a fight, in a snit with Tristan Zara, who she hates. Breton, is he the one who's so anti-homosexual because surrealism has to be pure? And then they have this whole conversation like, well, okay, so what about if you have sex with a woman with a dildo? Is that homosexual? you do that? And taking it all in, like the whole world of this male surrealist. And I studied with surrealist poets in French class in college. And I remember just, you know, having this feeling like, who the hell were these guys? The whole thing with automatic writing and, you know, all these wonderfully self-indulgent sort of little tricks they got up to you know, get themselves writing. And then the manifestos that they all wrote. And you completely brought it to life, but through the eyes of a young woman who is an artist in her own right. And you make us really know how good her work is, right from the get-go. How every time I say right from the get-go, I think of gecko. Anyway, yeah, it's now I have all these surrealist things going on in my brain. But the way that the women all band together, and they're always taking their clothes off. Yeah. And they're always cooking, and they're always, you know, they're doing their work, but they are women. I mean, they're not really trying to be men, but they have this, and this I've noticed in groups of women writers, definitely all through my life, wherever I live, there's always this kind of female solidarity working in a world where, you know, men are considered more important than you are, but you consider one another important. And so you show these friendships between Leonora and her fellow female artists in this way that is just, it's wonderful. It's deep and it's funny, and they aren't competitive with one another, and they're very sexy with one. It's like a utopian kind of vision of how that life might have been. And so I was like, I love this book for making me want to be except for the, you know, the horrible scenes with Max when he's taken away. But the entire art, the world of art back then was so important. Like the openings they had, and the sort of the way you could rock the art world by, you know, doing things. So I'm wondering if there was a bit of nostalgia also for you, wishing that you had lived back then.
Oh God, so much. I would have loved to have lived then. I know, like you said, though, besides like the war, right? Tough. But wow, yeah, they're you know, I love their sense of play and like of living fully. Right at the beginning of the book, after Max and Leonora meet, they go to Lamb Creek, which is Roland Penrose's brother's place in Cornwall and Southern England. And yeah, they're like always taking their clothes off. And it's this whole group of people, right? Like Lee Miller, Roland, and then Noosh and Adie and Man Ray are like, and Man Ray and Lee Miller, of course, had a thing earlier, but they're more or less over, you know, but they're all hanging out, and they make art, you know, do kind of like maybe the productive stuff in the morning, but then all afternoon they play. And there's just such a great sense of like, oh my God, we're alive and we're not confined by what the rest of society thinks we should do. And then in the meantime, England is pretty conservative too. And like, there is this whole degenerate art thing, because the book had originally, the title was The Degenerates.
Oh.
And yeah, like off of Hitler's term for their art.
Right.
But the English felt that way too. And like Max's show is shut down. And but then they're off in their own idyllic world, and they have so much fun.
The intensity of their experience as artists is sort of almost in reaction to what's going on politically. That they are living much more fully. And I just have to say that I did not feel that way during the Trump years. I did not feel that my reaction to the Trump years was to live life to the fullest. And that was even before the pandemic. I feel like something shut down in a lot of people and became more political in a kind of flinty, like, you know, grassroots, like things gotta, you know, things have to change. But I'm not.
Yeah, I felt like we were so I felt so reactive to that. Like,
me too. Me too.
And it was angry. Cool. Yeah.
And but like, going on. Yeah. It's all still happening. So it's not over. But so the pleasure of this book for me, well, there were many pleasures on many levels. But the writing aside and the characters aside, it was just the opportunity to inhabit this world and to really inhabit it. I mean, I feel like what you've done as an imaginative leap into a historical figure, I've never done it. And I've just make people up. I never write about real people. and so, I mean, I kind of want to talk more about your sort of, I mean, it started with this self-portrait and it started with understanding why she smudged out the Irish fairy figure because her lover disapproved of it. And so that sort of took you in to her vulnerability and to her as an artist and as a young woman. But you take her from there through an insane asylum in Spain and this description of madness and her madness, which is also juxtaposed with the surrealism and the whole life she's had in Paris. And then it feels like almost like the sort of, you know, the precepts of surrealism, the sort of emphasis on irrationality and dreams and, you know, mysticism and folktales and everything just sort of explodes in her head and she loses touch with reality, but your writing doesn't. And so I feel like this is,
that's really good to hear.
It's amazing. It's like a high wire act you do through the spine of the center of the book, which is her descent into madness, but you as the writer sort of keep the reader fully aware of who she is and keep the language so precise that the book doesn't fall apart. And I admire that tremendously.
That's so good to hear. I know, that was the hardest part. That was really the hardest part. What is reality, right? And how to get really inside her head. Because I think I started when I was writing it, I was more outside of her, at least in her madness. Yeah, it was more like kind of seeing, it was hard. It was hard to get in there. But once I did, I wrote it first all in third person, which it ended up being in the end. But then I changed it all to first in a draft, and that helped me get inside her, at least like really in her madness. And then I guess seeing it as like, because it really, I guess I've come to think of this book as her origin story or something, you know, like a superhero or something. Yeah. But that connection with her, of her passion, her creativity and her visions. Yeah, I mean, God, when you see her paintings, you just see like these worlds she creates, right? And I want to live in those too, but a lot of them, some are scary also, but seeing that her, that kind of like the world is insane, right? At that time, like she's fleeing France and the Nazis are invading and like, oh my God, imagining being that young too. And like unmoored in that way. And that her kind of her max was her stability, I think, and he's not there. So how terrifying. And then her imagination with being with the surrealists has been so nurtured, I think, and got really powerful. So blending those two worlds of inside her with what was happening outside, it was a challenge. Yeah. That was a challenge.
Yeah. Well, you pulled it off, and hats off to you, because that seemed like it was, you know, I wondered how long and how many drafts and how many sort of attempts to get into that it took in a nuts and bolts writing kind of way.
Like even her kind of that time in the asylum and right before that too, when she's losing her hold on reality, I think, the objective reality. I wrote like over 100 pages of what became very small in the end. But yeah, so many drafts and so many pages that got.
I was also wondering about that first person thing, if you had tried it, because the closed third really works. I'm really glad you went with that as a choice. But I can feel the first person in a way that it's exciting, because you're very close to her sort of how she sees the world, her experiences, and seeing the world through her eyes in the closed third. I'm always aware in a good way that this is an imaginative act into a real person. Because I read like a writer, I guess we writers read like writers. And so I'm always trying to figure out, how did she do that? And the other thing I wanted to ask you about was.
Because it is really an imaginative act, right? Yeah.
Totally.
Go ahead.
When it's a real person, and it's okay. Here's my question. Yeah. I had another question about how you did that. The book opens with her at a gallery in New York, and it's a retrospective of her work. And she's being interviewed by a young woman who is very zealous and wants to ask the exciting questions. And so I'm wondering if that also was your way into the book. Like, these are questions you wanted to ask her, and are you sort of that young interlocutor? Interviewing her and the way that I love the way she can't answer. She just can't answer. So you had to write the book to get the answers. And so it really feels like Leonora is daring you to do it in your fictional sort of rendering of her. She's saying, well, young lady, why don't you figure it out?
Oh gosh. That's wonderful. I actually wrote that opening section last. I had more of a dream-ish thing up front, and it felt like really like kind of showing her and what she became seemed like a good opening. But I think all those questions that the interviewer is asking, yes, I would love to know those things, like in her words. But she so famously would refuse to talk about her art. Like, she wouldn't tell you about it, I guess. Like, there are things that aren't sayable, and that's why we have art. But then also, I guess she didn't, she didn't even really know how to answer them, I guess. Like, it was so, was it did she channel the visions through, or, you know, I don't know. But it did feel like I had to, once I did fall in love with her, I had to write this book to, like, know her.
Right.
To really go deep. Right. It is such an imaginative act. It's like, you know, who was the real Leonora Carey? Well, you know, that was her, but seemed like she had so many sides from her paintings, and so much to say. I feel so grateful that I got to take this journey with her and spend that kind of time, because I just don't. You know, you never know how long a book is going to take, really, right, when you start it. But I think it really just kind of like took that many years to go through the layers of what wasn't necessarily her to get to what I felt like was. You know,
this is a big book. It's very ambitious, and it's very, it covers a lot of time. It's almost like an imagined biography of her in a way. like a psychological sort of biography of her, but you also bring in so much else of what was going on around her. So it isn't just her little, you know, her little point of view, it's everything. It's sort of, you know, the time she lived in, all the other artists around her. I feel like a lot of research must have gone into this, but you don't feel it when you're reading. It just feels like you made these people up, like you were writing a novel. Like, oh, here's Dolly showing up. You know, the woman who used to be, you know, in a menage a trois with Max and Paul, and you know, it's just
Gala.
I mean, yeah. It would take years to get this world sort of fixed in your mind, like all the places they went and the way they lived and how they talked and what they wore. And it's as a historical novel, it was really immersive. It was really sort of believable. And I wanted also to talk about the end, just touch on it a little bit, when she ends up in Mexico. And she has, I feel like there's always been something apocalyptic and very dark in her. Like as Max says, when he finally approves of one of her paintings, he says, "You painted your nightmare. You had the courage. You are really amazing." So there is something, there is always a sort of, I think it's like, as you said, it's an ecological sort of apocalypse caused by the patriarchy, which also feels really timely, caused by sort of the destruction of the earth for money and ultimately, and war. And so she creates this life of domesticity. She has children and she has a husband and moves to Mexico City. And you create this image of her at the center. And what you just read about the power of the woman in the home, in the kitchen, like you don't have to throw it all out to be a real artist. You can find power in daily life, find power in the kitchen, find power in serving food. And you start the book with a full moon dinner of all white food. And you end the book with a full moon dinner of all white food. And so it's like, but what has happened in between these, this is why I love the food in the book, because I love it when food is telling the story along with everything else, the engines of the book, that what has happened to Leonora between these two dinners with the same idea is the book and is her life and is sort of, you know, it's this beautiful kind of coming full circle from learning to cook in the kitchen with Feeney to being sort of the center of this very creative, very sort of exciting world in Mexico City, which, you know, but I don't want to give away too much of the ending. But it just feels like just you finish the book and then you have this introduction also, which, you know, tells you about what happens later. It's interesting that you wrote it last. I absolutely believe that. That makes total sense.
I know. I loved so much a relationship with the women and creating kind of magic with food. It was something maybe because it started with the white foods, but it just felt so right there at the end too. And that she's met Remedios then, or again, they met in
France, right?
Yeah, in France. And then they both end up in Mexico City and they just became such close friends and confidants and shared their magic and their painting with each other and their dreams. And I would love to know more about them and their relationship in Mexico, because it was such a partnership of creativity. And so much of her, like later of Leonora's later paintings too, revolve around kitchens. And there's this sense of the alchemical kitchen. And they had these magic recipes also to make, God, what were some of them? Like just like making their dreams kind of bloom. I don't know. It But then Leonora also would like make, she would dye tapioca with squid ink and make it seem like it was caviar, right? And you know, just having so much fun with these things.
And the hair omelets, when she sneaks around everyone's hair when they're sleeping, she gets little, I pictured little kind of dustings of hair and makes them each an omelet with a place card, and they all start eating and they're like, wait, there's hair in my food. What the hell?
Yeah, that was some of the most fun. I know we have to get on to the questions, but research too. I did kind of try it out on my husband, but he didn't eat much. You know, I used my own hair though. I didn't cut his hair at night like she did. But yeah, you gotta have to kind of try it out to see how it can work, right?
Yes. I was wondering if you had done that.
I did. It felt a little, you know, going a little far, a little on the wild side.
Your art. This is right? So delightful. Yeah. I'm having the best time. I'm just having the best time thinking about different things I've read by Carrington and wanting to dive further into the novel. This has been like lovely. We do have some questions coming in from the audience. The first one was from Pete, who was asking about Michaela, about the art community in Prescott and what that has been like as a writer and as a painter.
Oh gosh, that's so great. It wasn't last year because that was COVID year. I guess it was 2017, but we, a group of women, like inspired by the Surrealists and by this book that I was writing, got together and kind of formed this Prescott Surrealist Society. And we put on a show with my good friend Slade Graves, her art, and we did performance art. And it was just really, really fun. So I have been so inspired by the literary community in Prescott and the art group. And again, I would say, especially the women and those bonds that we've formed, and then supporting each other and having fun and playing.
Well, this conversation is making it very clear to me that you can do that with just about anyone on the planet. I feel like you and Kate, from this conversation, I feel like you and Kate have known each other for a million years, and I have no idea if you've actually ever met before.
Well, no, we haven't yet. That's what's so much fun.
I wanted to tell you, I went to high school. I went to Mingus Union High School. I lived in Jerome for high school, and I'm from Arizona. And I used to go on dates in Prescott. The boys from my high school would take girls to the movies in Prescott. And then we would stop on Mingus Mountain and have like campfires and roast marshmallows and make out after the date. So I feel this Arizona connection with you. Anyway, I just wanted to.
I do too with you. I know. I think you grew up your like house, but off Bethany Home, like 5 blocks away from where I grew up.
No kidding.
Yeah, it is.
We were on San Miguel.
So funny. It was on State Avenue.
Did you go to Simpson, Simpson Junior High?
Yeah, I knew it. I didn't. I went to Madison Meadows and then Central. But
yeah. That's amazing.
I totally knew it.
That's it. It's the Arizona thing.
That's delightful. Melissa wants to know, do your dreams, your night dreams influence your work, Michaela?
Ah, that's so cool. Definitely, yeah. I mean, they make it into paintings, but then also I think dreams worked their way into this novel too. And a lot of times I would be reading, because I read so many books, like all the books I could get my hands on, but I would read them like at night before I fell asleep, you know, and then kind of like write down little like a sentence or something that would come to me and then dream, of course, and then get up and write things. So I'm sure these like the dreams that are in the book are probably mine. You know, just the way as a writer, you kind of meld with your characters, I think, as you write them.
And then we have another question about how your poetry connects to this new novel in terms of like how you've learned to tell stories, because you've written so many poetry books. And that's from Ellen. Curious about that.
Oh, Ellen. Ellen is my wonderful teacher and the founder and head of Warren Wilson College for the longest time. And I love you, Ellen. And poetry. You know, I feel like I got away with a lot of poetry being in this novel, and I didn't know if it would fly necessarily, because it's novels can be written so many ways. But for me, a lot of the writing comes down to rhythm. And I agree with Virginia Woolf, who in one of her journals, I think, said it, that it comes down, or one of her letters, something to rhythm. Once she knows the rhythm of her book, she can move forward with it. And I think that's so true for me and for this book too. And yeah, there was a passage that I was maybe going to read, another one that has food in it, but it is super dreamlike. I don't know, when Max gets back from being in the camp for the first time, but he, I worked as much in as I could.
Awesome. It looks like those are all the questions. I'm going to give a couple more minutes. If you wanted to read this excerpt, it's such beautiful writing. I'm sure we would be delighted to hear it.
Well, I don't know. I could
find it. I didn't mean to like put you
on the spot. Yeah.
The worst thing to do as a host is to put you on the spot.
I could just read this one paragraph, because it is, you'll see,
it'll tie to all the questions. That sounds lovely.
Okay. The peacocks perched on the stone wall to greet him, squawking the tale of Orpheus from beginning to end, though no one understood it but Leonora. She lit every candle in the house. She changed into a dress of white lace, combed the dust from her hair, and perfumed herself with dried lavender and rosemary. She cooked lamb on their new stove, a stove her mother had sent her money for, insisting that she eat. Something so hard to do during those 3 long months Max had been gone. But now he was home, and the cats, who had become transparent, slipped back into their coats, thick and lusty for winter. It was Christmas, and she drew a hot bath for the man she had lost, the man whose return from the underworld had returned her too. That essential beast that was her soul had come to the stable to eat and drink, to love again. She burned his clothes, stiff with sweat, stinking of airless rooms, of bricks and chalk and shit, of the beard of an old mule and the world's doom.
That's so beautiful. That's like a poem.
I have one more question from the audience. I'm a little bored asking questions after a passage that profound.
It's like there's a lot in there.
I mean, but like the density of poetry is so magnificent that way. Like the that's a paragraph that's like four you know, chapters of another story. Truly, it's really, really beautiful. Ty asks, not my words. Ty asks about how you dealt with the historical events and their sequencing, when it conflicted with where the story wanted to build. In other words, how accurate were the events and characters in the story, given that you were playing with all of these the memory of all these real people?
Yeah. That was really a question that I wasn't sure what direction I would go with it at first, because you just start writing, but I wanted really to tell their stories. I felt like who Leonora became really had to do with what she went through as a young woman, and her time in the asylum, and that it was this individuation process for her. So I hope I'm not giving away too much about the book, but you can look it up in 1 second on Wikipedia. And also it's written in this cyclical way. So, you know, they don't end up together, but it's a love story. And I wanted that love to come through. And I kind of struggled with that at first, like, could I end somehow in their idyllic country setting that where they have each other, and it's this beautiful moment, you know, before it's all destroyed. But it seemed in the end like the final, like the just telling it as it happened. Although there is the timeline thing in the book of, you know, Leonora's perspective is 3 years before Max's, and then catches up to his, and he's already separated from her and on this cattle car on the train, trying to flee from the Nazis at the beginning. And so that felt like it lent some immediacy to it too. And we knew where it was going a bit. But it ended up that their story was really the one that wanted to come through in this book.
It does. It's heartbreaking. It does.
Yeah. I felt like it was heartbreaking. It is quite a story. And yet I think they had to be together at the beginning. And they were for her to like reach her potential. And then she had to leave him too, to not be in his shadow and all that. By the end, just even as much as they loved each other. And apparently she would never talk about Max either. So maybe that's another thing that the book is like a way to know what were they to each other. And, you know,
that's why we read
love she wouldn't talk about.
That's why historical novels are so exciting when they're done like this, when they're done so deeply and so beautifully and so well. I hope everybody who came tonight buys this book and reads it. I can't imagine not loving it. It's enthralling.
Thank you so much, Kate. Thank you so much for being here. I just want to say too, that I have The Last Cruise here and I love it so much. Yeah. It's one of my staff picks. So.
Oh, thanks. Well, I hope we can all meet in person and have a drink someday. I wish we could go do it now with the whole
audience. That would be the next right now. It's been such a beautiful, beautiful evening, Michaela and Kate. Thank you so, so much for joining us. Thank you to everyone who also joined us. Thanks so much for reading such beautiful excerpts and giving us so much hope about the kind of ways we can live through difficult moments and difficult times with such an incredible novel. And we will see you all for our next event soon. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Greenlight Bookstore podcast. We're grateful to our production partners at Libro FM for working with us to produce the quarantine season. Libro FM provides access to thousands of digital audiobooks through partnerships with independent bookstores nationwide. You can purchase Libro FM audiobooks at greenlightbookstore.com. You can subscribe to the Greenlight Bookstore podcast on iTunes, download it as a free audiobook from Libro FM, or stream it on greenlightbookstore.com/podcast. On the Greenlight website, you can also find links to purchase the books discussed in this episode and many more, as well as information about Greenlight's store locations and shopping hours. The best way to support your local independent bookstore and the literary communities we serve is as simple as buying a book.